those are introductions, because the panelists you've heard from already today. So without further ado, I will hand over to John with just the reminder, please do keep putting questions into the Q&A channel if you have any. We'll do our best to get to as many of them as we can. So without further ado, welcome back, panelists, and over to you, John.
Thank you, Steve. And welcome, Mike, Altaz, and Ava. Hopefully you guys are all ready to answer some questions. So I've been keeping an eye on our Q&A box as we've been going through our presentations. So I'll, I guess, kick it off in the order that I saw the questions. So I'll direct my first one to you, Mike. Looking at adopting privacy risk within FAIR, so how would you say that Open FAIR would look at privacy risk?
So I kind of saw that question in the question box, and I'm glad I can answer it. Privacy risk is just one of the many risks associated with information that a business that we'll call the stakeholder has to manage. We would look at privacy risk from that stakeholder's perspective, which would be different than looking at it from the public's perspective or the consumer's perspective. But what is the impact to the primary stakeholder, the business? And we would model that as how often that occurs, what could make it occur, like what kind of confidentiality breach, how often would that occur? And then what is the significance or implications of it? Like, how do we respond to that? How do we have to deploy business resources to deal with the media, to respond and investigate these security events? And then look at, so how do we deal with the fallout from that privacy, from the privacy considerations, from a confidentiality loss? And that would come usually in the form of additional response, like credit monitoring for affected individuals, or identity theft protection for affected individuals. Notification to comply with regulation would be part of a necessary response that we would include those costs. And then anything like exposures to fines and judgments that might come from, in more extreme cases, from certain privacy breaches. So to my mind, FAIR is very well set up to address losses associated with privacy that are associated with confidentiality breaches if we just look at it in a structured way.
Great, thank you, Mike. Anything you'd like to add to that, Altaz or Ava?
Nope, not from my side.
And I would say that from a HIPAA perspective, this would be a very good methodology to use for trying to put in the controls when you're looking at the security rule. Because you can actually, you know, as Mike said, you can look at how often this would happen and what would be the consequences. And we know that for some of the HIPAA stuff, if you're not doing your job, the consequences can be pretty steep in fines. If you are shown to be doing due diligence, then OCR is a little bit nicer. So I think that taking a good look from a quantitative point of view of, you know, and then showing that you have done your due diligence, especially since risk analysis is a really important part of HIPAA, I think this would be a very valuable tool to use.
And I've always been impressed with the HIPAA regulation that it starts out in many chapters, in many paragraphs, uses the term reasonable and appropriate.
Yep.
So how you define what reasonable and appropriate are can be done, in my view, through a risk-based argument.
Exactly. And if you're not using a risk-based argument, that is the first thing that OCR is going to come hit you with, because the risk analysis is the first thing they ask for.
Great. Thank you both very much. So our next question then, as a little bit of context, see that some threats can appear at multiple places over a very short period of time. So are there any mechanisms for early detection or alert systems that might help prevent further propagation of that threat? I guess this sort of relates to the difference between a contact event, threat event, and loss event. Anybody want to take the ball on that one?
I can take a first crack at this, John, and then leave it open. When we talk about security, there are multiple pieces that come together to help us fill out when we're talking about risk, you know, where we might be able to gather this kind of data from. So as an example, the normal approach that we would see, I shouldn't say normal, it's the typical approach that we see, would be to have people go through a defensive approach, which would be to look at threat modeling or to look at a SAS scan or something like that to help us build security in, to help us build that resiliency in the software that we're producing. And I'm using software as a context here. Now, when this goes into production, what we have is there are tools that can be used to monitor what is happening on the production side and be able to feed that information back into the development cycle. So we may use OSINT tools, for example, that would enable us to see where gaps are. As an example, we've got a lot of repositories that are publicly known that identify what the current vulnerabilities are. And what we need to do is bring that in now in a way that will allow us to map to the activities that we're doing against the application, not just that, but be able to map when we do the software, what does that mean from a risk standpoint? Is doing this really going to help me lower my risk? Just because I've detected something or heard about something, you know, when it comes in, if everything comes in, then we're starting to create a lot of noise and we may end up with false positives, or we may end up focusing on things that may not be important ultimately to the business. And so when we talk about risk, this is something that we have to think about, you know, how do we align to what is ultimately going to be important to the business? Because the modus operandi from a security perspective is twofold. On the one hand, we're trying to enable the business, and on the other hand, we're trying to manage risk. And it's not, again, an either or, it's both. So this balance has to be in there.
Thank you, Altaz. Anything to add, Mike or Ava?
No, I don't think so for me.
Not for me.
Right. Next up then, do you think that using some lean approach such as the five whys and root cause analysis would help detail the chain of risk? This might be another good one for you, Altaz.
Yeah, I was just about to step in. Yeah, certainly. So, first of all, it's interesting you bring up lean. You know, we've had conversations in the industry many times around agile and DevOps. And as we start to take a look at higher level, more abstract processes that cut across different business units, it's inevitable that you're eventually going to run into, are we doing this as efficiently as possible? And so that brings us into a conversation around lean. So when we talk about lean, and particularly when we look at it from a risk standpoint, and I'm going to just limit my response to just risk. First of all, I think it's important to realize that there's a lot of legacy scaffolding that we've got around risk. It doesn't mean that we throw everything away. What we do is we gradually evolve this, and there may be some things that require us to do things in a certain way because we've had to in the past comply with certain you know, regulations, as an example. Nevertheless, it starts off by looking at what's the business context, what are we trying to achieve from a risk standpoint, and then identifying what are the specific risk assessment techniques or steps that we can go through. Now, we've talked about FAIR. FAIR can be used to go in there and to assist with this. There could be a broader set of steps, which would include, for example, trying to understand elicitation from the stakeholders. What's a lean way of doing this? And again, there are many different ways. It could be an interview, it could be a survey. Lean depends on the context of the organization. And as we go through each step and eventually produce the final outcome, we have to go back and measure from a risk standpoint, what was our intention and what was the final outcome? And if there's a delta, there's an opportunity there from a lean perspective to look at continuous improvement. So I've just touched at a very high level, but there are standards out there, FAIR being one of them, ISO 31000, 31010. You know, we've got the risk, the NIST RMF. And just following that through, looking at it from the perspective of the steps that you need to go through and how do we do this as efficiently as possible, is kind of the methodology that I would advocate to follow.
Thank you, Altaz. Our next question then, so when related to commercially provided services, how would risk categorizations factor into objectively calculating things like service level agreements, such as uptime, and key performance indexes, such as MTBF and MTTF? Any takers for that one?
I'd like to start with that a little bit. So I think that you can ask yourself what those service level agreements, if they're breached, mean to you. So you can work with your vendors to, you know, define what they are, and then say, okay, if I have for sake of argument, a 1% unavailability of this service, and it violates a service level agreement at that level, what is my financial impact to that? And FAIR would help you assess that through things like, what's my productivity loss? What are my response costs going to be associated with that? Maybe in the worst case, how much would it cost me to replace this service with a different service? And what might the fallout be from my downstream partners, whether they're customers or maybe there's even another impact to some other supplier or something from a highly integrated supply chain set of services like this. So I think FAIR gives you the language for talking about that problem. And from that language, a framework to decompose it into actionable units of thought that you can then analyze.
And if I could just add to what Mike was just talking about, I think when we look at risk and we look at vendor risk assessments, yes, there's certainly ways to go in and to measure that risk from a monitoring standpoint. What I've seen is there's a lot of manual attestation that takes place today. And I think what we have to be cognizant of is when you sign up in the contract, there has to be some penalty clause, something in there that holds a vendor accountable if they slip on an SLA, whether that's through the form of credits or whether it's looking at a different service or you have an exit clause. This is something, especially as we consider the integrations with all the systems that we've got today, if we've got systems going down, it could have an impact on business continuity. And so from a risk standpoint, we would want to assess the business continuity impact against a particular service going down. And if so, look at it from a mitigation standpoint and look at ways that we might be able to reduce that risk.
And actually, I'm looking at this and I'm going, this is one of those examples where you actually have numbers to plug in to the formulas. And you know what your potential fine would be. You can actually build your program around the SLA that you want to meet and then do your calculations to figure out what the various loss scenarios would be, and then be comfortable with what you're willing to accept in a client contract, you know, having real numbers behind it.
Yeah, I'm going to add one more thing to that. There's a possibility, and I've seen just a little bit of, I know there's research in this area, there's actually been Nobel Prizes awarded in contracting, but it may be that the SLA is, with penalties is not a good contractual framework, that it may be something more like a relational contract for something as significant as a key vendor, where you're mutually dependent upon each other, may serve better to govern the to govern the relationship and the services being provided. So time will tell, but there, as we get more embedded with key suppliers and as the stakes get higher, the contractual relationships themselves may change.
All right, thank you all for those answers. Our next question then, would it be a correct assessment to say that security and privacy by design is expected to look through the process model to enable privacy and security?
So I can take a crack at that. I don't think you can get away from process. This is a governance question. And first of all, just looking at privacy by design, you know, we've got frameworks that guide us. But auditing something like privacy by design is very difficult. So maybe looking at something else like ISO 27701, something like that might be a better way to go about looking at it. But when you look at the activities that you need to do, eventually somebody is going to have to assume certain roles. And when you start to look at that, immediately you're looking at an accountability that gets instilled. I think there is definitely going to be some process issues there that need to come out. The question that I think I'm seeing in the industry is the degree of automation that's possible. So on the one hand, we've got cybersecurity, and we're focused on trying to automate the DevOps pipelines, and we've got security built into that, and we can map that directly to applications. And then we've got another school of thought on the privacy side, and there are two schools of thought on whether or not we can automate privacy. On the one hand, privacy starts to enter into legal obligations. Can we automate certain legal interpretations without a human being involved, as an example? So therein lies perhaps some manual process in some cases. Nevertheless, I think the intent of the question is, do we need to get into a governance model when we deal with cybersecurity and privacy, to which I say yes. You will need your tools, you will need your processes, you will need to have your metrics, and ultimately, in the previous panel, when we look at the value that's being provided, it has to be something that ultimately maps back to business value.
Thank you, Altaz. Looks like we've got time for one more question, and I have a feeling you'll like this one, Mike. How do we see in-vehicle cybersecurity concerns addressed in connected and autonomous vehicles, and what role is played by OEMs with respect to government regulations emerging in this area?
I don't quite know why I would like that, that's a big question. Can you just kind of unpack it a little bit for me? Maybe take it in two chunks.
Sure. So I guess first let's answer, how do you see in-vehicle cybersecurity concerns being addressed in connected and autonomous vehicles? Or how would they be addressed?
Well, I'm not an expert in this area. It's really hard for me to weigh in on this. When you have this many players and this many, and you're in a mixed mode environment between autonomous and, you know, human agents driving things, it really comes down to, are there some approaches to driving that are make us net better off through automation or through human operation? I think, so that's going to come down to being, I think, more of a technology, AI, and from a total public benefit standpoint, a cost-benefit analysis between competing alternatives. And I'm just not enough of an expert in that field to say much more about it.
So I can inject a couple of thoughts in this. When we look at in-vehicle cybersecurity concerns, so we are really looking at both hardware and software converging. It's not the only domain this is happening in. We see it in IoT and a bunch of other domains as well. And when we look at cybersecurity, one of the challenges that we've got is from a software standpoint, our focus is really on trying to maintain the security of the applications themselves. Whereas if we look at the hardware side, particularly in vehicles, actually cybersecurity isn't the top priority, it's safety. And so there are these standards being developed right now, for example, P1228 at the IEEE, which is trying to bring secure software together. So we're on the one hand focused on security, on the other hand focused on the hardware, so in this case autonomous vehicles, but it could be medical devices and so on and so forth. Now, when we talk about cybersecurity concerns on this, from a software standpoint, the velocity of the software tends to be a little bit faster. We can do updates, we can flash it, whereas on the hardware side, tends to have a longer shelf life, and in some cases may in fact be difficult to go in and to try to figure out how we can manage this security on an ongoing basis. So when we look at this, the requirements, first of all, going right into these kinds of contexts needs to be made very clear. What's the overall risk exposure? When I say risk, I'm looking here really at vulnerabilities that, to the best of our knowledge today, we're willing to accept. And could we put a software layer around some of the vulnerabilities that we perceive so that we might be able to go in there and patch and be able to close those loops off at some point in the future if we think that this would be an issue. But when it comes to dealing specifically with how do we now go in and how do we mitigate against those, we have to, as a team, think not only on the software side, but also consider what the hardware component of this is going to be. And that's what I would suggest is when we look at it from a cybersecurity standpoint, realize that the two domains are first of all focused on fundamentally different priorities, yet we need to bring the two together. So it becomes both security and safety is important. Bring it together, come up with a list of controls that are necessary to go in there and help you manage this sort of IoT space or the convergence of software and hardware. And I know we've kind of run out of time, but there's a lot more that can be said on this as well. Thank you.
Yes, we've passed our time now by just over a minute. So thank you all for joining this panel, and I'll turn the time back over to the events team.